To talk about, we got to thank some of the people that have been part of the show. Joe Aguilar from the Daily Herald / ABC, Steve Brandy. Also, Dave Zenner over at Arlington Park as they're getting their season started. Opening day coming up next Friday in Arlington Heights. Tim Reynolds, head baseball coach over at Wakanda High School. Rory Dames with the Red Stars as they have a game tonight with the Washington Spirit, 7 or 7:30. Over in Lisle at Illinois Benedictine College. Lindsey Wilhite with the winning Chicago Wolves. And thanks to Ron and thanks to you, Pat. By the way, Tech Talk comes your way next with Michael Kassler. Bob Pia comes in at 11 o'clock. Stay with us. A lot of things going on here at WRLR. Have yourself a good week. We'll talk to you again next Saturday morning. So long, everybody.
You're listening to 98.3 FM, WRLR LP, Round Lake Heights, Illinois.
Has your mouse stopped mousing, your keyboard stopped keyboarding, and your computer stopped, well, computing? Then you need to listen to Tech Talk. We're on Saturdays from 10 to 11 a.m. or listen to us reboot Tech Talk Wednesday mornings 9 to 10 a.m. This is Tech Talk.
Galaxy Stone Design is a proud sponsor of WRLR. Galaxy Stone Design has over a decade of experience in the fabrication and installation of granite and marble surfaces in the Chicagoland area. Their team of professionals handles commercial to residential projects. Galaxy Stone Design inventory includes granite, marble, handstone, and siltstone surfaces. For more information, their telephone number, 847-271-7233. Their website is galaxystonedesign.com.
Today's broadcast is made possible through the generous support of Sports Decal. Sports Decal is a Northern Illinois decal and apparel company that is family-owned and operated. It has been in business for over 40 years, providing sportswear to high schools and colleges throughout the United States. Sports Decal's website is www.sportsdecal.com. Their phone number is 800-435-6110.
You're listening to 98.3 FM, WRLR LP, Round Lake Heights, Illinois.
Would you be my friend? Onto
a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I'd probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today. This is a special edition of the Tech Talk Show. The interviews you're about to hear were recorded live at Conglomeration 2014 down in Louisville, Kentucky, about 2 weeks ago. Now, I've got two interviews queued up and ready to go. You're going to enjoy both of them. The first one is going to be Dr. Les Johnson, science fiction author, as well as an actual legitimate rocket science from NASA. Then we're going to have Ookla the Mock with Rand and Adam from Ookla the Mock, a fantastic band, and also the musical guest of honor at Conglomeration. If you haven't heard of them, haven't heard about them, you're going to want to listen in for sure to the second half of this or go find them yourself before then. I'm going to be playing a couple of songs from them as well. We'll do one in the middle and I'll grab you one at the end also. Again, a reminder, this is a pre-recorded show. No Facebook texts, messages, voicemails, call-ins, or anything will be received, but enjoy it. And if you're listening to the podcast, of course, you'll enjoy it over and over and over again, hopefully. Thanks again. You're listening to Tech Talk, and up next here is going to be Dr. Les Johnson and then Ookla the Mock.
Let's kick into it. So I am here with Dr. Les Johnson, and Dr. Johnson, I'm going to let you do your own intro, as you're going to do a much better job than I possibly could.
Okay. Well, first off, thanks for having me. And I'm Les Johnson, and I am a physicist
science fiction author as well as an author of popular science books. And my day job, though, I work for NASA at the Marshall Space Flight Center down in Huntsville, Alabama.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. So you write science fiction, though, as well as being involved with actual real science.
Yeah, I sure do. And one thing I have to be careful here is that anything I say is my own opinion and not NASA's, although I do work there. Yeah, I sure do. I started writing popular science books back in the mid-2000s. Just generally about space and space exploration. And one thing led to another, and I ended up collaborating on a book with Travis Taylor, who is a science fiction writer and a scientist who writes for Bayon Books. And the book was called Back to the Moon, and it did fairly well. And so now I've started writing some science fiction books under contract to Bayon.
Very cool. Which is actually follows a long line of NASA scientists and other scientists who then get involved with writing science fiction as well.
Well, for me, it's kind of a continuous loop, though, because I started working for NASA and decided I wanted to study physics because of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was a kid. I was watching Star Trek and reading science fiction novels. And that's what made me decide I wanted to go into a career in science and work for NASA. So for me, it's kind of payback.
Yeah.
It was what inspired me. And now that I'm in my 50s, early 50s, and in my career, I want to kind of inspire that next generation. So it's kind of a do loop here that's going kind of going back to the beginning.
Very cool. Very cool. Do you find that the science is informing your science fiction, or is your science fiction informing the things that you're interested in science?
Well, the science is really just the backdrop. You know, a good science fiction story is all about people. It's about putting people in situations that are unfamiliar, that are challenging, and how people react to it. And the thing I like about science fiction and the way I look at it is that the science part of it is the backdrop, the backstory, and the gee whiz factor. And the real element is how the people interact and deal with that. Because that's what, in my opinion, that's what good science fiction will be. So in terms of the way the science influences it, for me, good science in science fiction should be almost transparent to the reader, in that you're reading it and you find these characters in this situation that make sense, it doesn't violate any known laws of physics, and you're thinking, wow, how would I react under those conditions? Yeah.
Yeah. So that being said then, what were some of those classic science fiction stories and things that got you excited about science?
Oh, my. Well, if any of your listeners are science fiction fans, you'll recognize some of the names of authors, of course, the big three, Isaac Asimov, and his Foundation trilogy, and he went back late in his life before he passed away and extended that and connected that universe to his robot novels, which I just thought was brilliant. So I've enjoyed him throughout my life, his writings. And, of course, Arthur C. Clarke, Heinlein, and modern authors, too. Stephen Baxter.
Oh, yes.
Is one of those really gee-whiz, awe-inspiring science fiction writers whose mm-hmm. work I really, really like.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's a lot of good science and science fiction writers out there. Those are the ones that really pop close up into my head.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a great list, yeah, for people that are listening who are thinking about getting involved with some stuff. So what do you do then in your day job? What is it that you're actually involved with when you're not writing and sharing that passion?
Well, the bulk of my time is my day job, and I'm one of those very fortunate people that is kind of living the dream. I love what I do. And in my day job currently, I'm in the Advanced Concepts office, and our job is what it sounds like. We look at the next generation of space systems. What are we going to be doing in space in the next 15 to 25 years? And we have about 30 engineers and scientists who work with other scientists and engineers to basically build spacecraft concepts around their science instruments to see if it's possible, what technologies are needed. We look at advanced propulsion technologies for new missions. Our office did the initial designs of NASA's Space Launch System, the new heavy lift vehicle that's being built. All the trade studies that went on for about 2 years before the final design was settled on, where they looked at all the variations of chemical and solid and liquid engines and how big it would have to be. All those trade studies were done by the folks in our office. So that's kind of my day job. I recently served as the deputy manager. But last fall, I had a project selected for flight for which I'm the principal investigator. And it's a mission that's going to fly in 2017. So I've stepped off to be really the PI of that mission for the next 3 years.
Oh, great. So. Great. Will that be a manned flight?
No, it sure won't be. In fact, just the opposite. It's a small spacecraft that will use a solar sail, which is, for listeners that may not be familiar with this, a solar sail uses reflected sunlight from a large, thin reflector, think really thin aluminum foil. And as the light reflects off that, it pushes on it, and it'll move it through space. So we're going to use that as a propulsion system to go visit a near-Earth asteroid.
Oh, very cool. So unlike our solar cells, which take that photon light and convert it to electrical energy, this is actually taking a very direct pressure.
It's solar pressure. That's exactly the term we use. And so you may not realize it's there. But when you're out in the sun, in addition to warming your skin with all that light being absorbed, it's pushing on you. But it's not much of a push. You'll never notice it. In fact, it's really, really hard to measure. It's so small. And if you want to think about it, it's on the order of an ounce per football field.
Mm.
So you would have to take a whole football field of our lightweight reflective material, which is thinner than a human hair, and stretch it out over a football field to get an ounce of pressure on it.
Wow.
So it's a very small force. But when you're in space, it's constant, it's always there, and you can use it to move around. And the nice thing is you never run out of gas. So you don't have to bring any fuel, and as long as you're flying literally where the sun is shining, you've got propulsion.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about, of course, things in space? I mean, space is pretty big, so there's not a lot of stuff, but there's enough things. If it's that thin and that, I would assume, fragile, too.
It's more robust than you think. If I were to give you a piece of this and ask you to tear it, you'd have a tough time doing it.
Okay.
It really can happen, and we've looked at that, and so what we find is that it's so thin and things are moving so fast that they essentially, you can't see it listening, obviously, but I'm showing my fingers moving and waving my arms, that it would just punch a little hole through it and not do much damage at all.
And not matter.
And if we end up getting a tear, we would design in ripstop, little Kevlar cords, so that it would contain the tear to a small segment of the sail. But we don't expect too much damage from that. So.
And I imagine, it's different from thinking of a wind-driven sail in that even if you do have some variety of holes and gaps,
it still works.
It's not going to be as...
That's right. It's not like you get any pressure funneled through that hole. It would just be a hole where you wouldn't have reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you have the worst case on some of these and lose 5 to 10% of your area, all that does is cost you 5 to 10% of your thrust.
Yeah.
So you still have the majority of it happening, and we don't have any estimates of that much damage occurring. You'd have to be out there for decades to get that kind of damage. So it's really not going to be that much of an issue. It's far more likely that some other system on the spacecraft will stop working than you would have damage to your sail.
And how long will it take to get to where you want to go using that system?
Well, it's not as hard as you'd think. It just depends on how things line up. So it depends on when we launch and what near-Earth asteroids are nearby. But our flight time, we think, will be about a year and a half.
Okay.
And that's not too bad.
No.
So, yeah. And we have to rendezvous fairly close in because you have to have the ability to transmit the data back. And this is a very small spacecraft. For those that aren't familiar with CubeSats, this would be about the size of 3 loaves of bread combined, the spacecraft, and we're going to deploy a sail that is 80 square meters.
Hmm.
So booms coming out of that about 20 feet long, deploying the sail. So it's going to look really awesome.
That's very cool. So we'll move on maybe to a different topic in a second. But so just the getting that out there, and then, I mean, are there multiple stages then before it's able to deploy that entire 80 meters?
Not so much. What we have to do, to get off the ground, you have to use a rocket, right? So these little spacecraft, there are universities launching CubeSats all the time. They're pretty standard these days, these little teeny spacecraft. So there are lots of rockets that have their primary spacecraft, which might weigh a couple of tons.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take our spacecraft, which will weigh 20 pounds, right? So, and the different launch vehicles now are configured to carry several of these up with them. And after the primary spacecraft goes off, whatever it is, could be a communications satellite, could be a defense satellite, could be a science spacecraft, then they start kicking off these little spacecraft. So once we get off the ground and into space, these little spacecraft with whatever their propulsion system can go virtually anywhere.
Ah, okay. So there'll probably be multiple things deployed.
That's right.
On this single event.
Yeah,
okay.
And ours will just be one. And in terms of the actual deployment of our sail, if that's what you're talking about, it'll happen quickly. These booms are stowed under tension. And so as soon as we release them, it'll be like a tape measure in reverse. You know how when you push your tape measure button, it all reels in?
Yeah.
Well, these are stored so that they're under tension and where they're going to spring out and pull the sail. So our whole sail, which is pretty big, will be deployed in just a few minutes.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. Cool.
Yeah. And believe me, it'll be a nail-biting few minutes.
Is that the riskiest part of the...
That's the riskiest part. That sure is.
Makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. Do you see this technology or similar technology being something that's going to be used for larger scale transport?
Yeah, I sure do. And in fact, if you'll pardon the shameless plug, I'm a co-author on a book called Solar Sails, A Novel Approach to Interplanetary Travel. It's published by Springer. We're getting ready to go into our second edition of the book. And in the book and in some talks I give, I talk about how we might be able to use sails to explore most of the solar system. And my personal opinion is, in a century or two, that's how we'll send our first unmanned probes to other stars. Mm. We'll be with very, very large sails. You go from something that's the size of the area of, like, the floor of your living room, which is what I'm dealing with, to sails that might be the size of the state of Texas. Okay, now, we don't have a clue how to build anything that big yet, but there's no reason you can't. We just have to learn how to do it. But once we're able to build something that big, you could use the descendants of what we're going to be flying in the next few years, maybe to take us to the stars.
Very cool. Very cool.
My regret is I won't be able to be here to see it, but, you know, hey.
Yeah. Well,
as long as somebody does it, right?
That's exactly right. Exactly right. Is there any other technology that you think is going to really make a we're just going to see a huge difference coming, maybe not in our lifetimes, but something that's going to make an impact for our ability to achieve some of these things that we've been dreaming of for so long?
Well, yeah, I think there are. I think, and they're not all in propulsion. I think for propulsion, solar sails and electric propulsion, ion drive, which we're currently flying on spacecraft, and we're getting better and better in using, which uses electromagnetic energy to propel a spacecraft, are going to do that. But I also think that, personally, what's going to enable us to have a moon base to be self-sustaining, if you look back, is going to be the 3D printer.
Ah.
To me, what we've been seeing with 3D printers these last few years is basically that's a first-generation Star Trek replicator.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if I were putting myself 50 years in the future and writing the history of what enabled us to have a self-sufficient moon base, rockets would be one, two would be the 3D printer.
3D printer. I can see that. Jay and I have talked about 3D printers mm-hmm. quite a bit on the show, actually. And Jay, I don't have you read any of the things that Dr. Johnson has written? Or
no, I'm about to walk over to the convention dealer's room and buy them all. I haven't had the chance to read them.
Please,
you'll see Larry Smith Bookseller and purchase all of them. I do think it's interesting. I have worked with 3D printers, and I'm in complete agreement with him that is the next technology, I think, that needs to be really refined to get us into space, because, as Dr. Johnson could speak to way better than me, you don't know what you're going to need once you're out there and you have no resource to call back for it. So you literally need the ultimate Swiss Army knife, figure out what I need, and manufacture it on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
And we already have self-replicating 3D printers that can manufacture from themselves replacements for themselves. So all you need is to iterate from that as 3D printers that can create improved versions of themselves from base materials, and you've got basically a industrial economy going separated from the Earth biosphere.
Well, I think 3D printers, in addition to enabling space, I think they have the potential to change the dynamic of global economics. If you look at, you know, where mass production of small widgets is happening, you know, when you can go to your hardware store and they no longer have to warehouse all these parts, you just come in and say, I need this one. And they say, give us 2 minutes. Ding, you know, here's your part, right? For plumbing parts, for nuts, bolts,
yep.
Whatever. You change the dynamic of how we do all of our industrial base.
Well, and more than that, when you don't have to warehouse parts, you can have an unbelievable number of customized iterations. I need that in blue.
That's exactly right. You're right.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's going to change everything. And that's kind of one of the – you were mentioning my science fiction earlier. I just finished a novel with one of my heroes, Ben Bova, who I idolized when I was a kid, you know, reading science fiction, and I've collaborated with him on a book called Rescue Mode, which is coming out from Bayon in June. And as a backdrop, this science in engineering and society, we postulated that there'd been an economic upheaval between now and the 2030s that changed the whole geopolitical dynamic, and that was 3D printing.
I was going to say, yeah, that and there has been things written about what would happen with something that can just create pretty much anything.
That's right. What does that do to the whole mass marketing of things in China?
Yeah.
With regard to marketing to the world? What does that do to their economy? What does it do to ours?
Yeah. Well, and
it's dramatic.
Especially if the product you're creating is indistinguishable and of the same quality
Absolutely.
Level.
Absolutely.
I mean, what...
Absolutely. I think these things will be everywhere. I really do.
Yeah, yeah, and they're getting cheaper every day too. Yeah. So that does make a lot of sense. So now, and you're here, of course, joining us at Conglomeration, which is a fantastic science fiction fantasy convention. We're here in Louisville, Kentucky. You actually are doing a full track of science discussion and conversation and panels and things like that. What do you have going on this week here that you're interested or excited about or want to share?
Well, they're working me pretty hard, and I'm glad of it. I'm a science fiction fan from way back. I started going to conventions when I was in high school, and this is like the full circle of the writing. This is kind of me paying back to fandom, because what I have found at science fiction conventions is a lot of people here, although they may not be working in the fields of science and engineering, they are fans of science and engineering, and they are eager for information.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's like I'm around sponges, because people just don't hear it in the press. What you hear are the latest celebrity gossip, right?
Yeah.
You don't hear about all the cool stuff that's happening in the world of science. And so for space science, I'm here talking about, of course, things like solar sails and interstellar travel and how we might go to the stars. But I'm also getting ready in a few minutes to give a talk on my personal vision of what we ought to be doing in space over the next few decades, which is helping solve some real environmental and energy problems here on Earth. I'm a big advocate of space solar power. And if someone had said, Les, you know, where should we invest space technology for the next 25 years, I would say we ought to be doing it to build the prototype space solar power station so that we can stop burning all these fossil fuels and get our energy from space.
Hmm.
And once we're, if I were to take my grandchildren someday in the future and they would say, what has space done for me? I would point to the southern sky and see the ring of satellites beaming clean energy down to the Earth. And I would tell them that's what enabled us to get off of fossil fuels. And I believe once we have the infrastructure to do that,
mm-hmm.
then we will become a system, solar system-wide civilization.
Yeah.
Because once we have the economics of going to space and generating power there, then we can mine asteroids, and then we can start thinking about going on to another star.
Yeah.
So it, to me, it's the logical stepping stone that makes sense. So that's what I'll be talking about next, and then some various panels on moon exploration, basically what we ought to be doing,
mm-hmm.
and what we are doing in space exploration.
Cool. And, of course, part of the thing that needs to happen is, of course, there needs to be funding. And for the funding to happen, what you brought up, I think, is a really important point as well, is that, you know, we talk a lot in politics about how there's this, you know, income gap and there's equity gaps. But I think in science, we see a lot of this sort of reality gap where you've got on the one side, you've got, you know, yourself, you got the Phil Plates and the Neil deGrasse Tysons and so on, really getting the word out.
I'm very flattered you put me in that category. Thank you.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, someone who's knowledgeable in the science and spreading the word and sharing that knowledge and making it approachable and attainable for people, like you said, who are laymen, who are not perhaps steeped in the engineering background. But on the other extreme, then you've got and Jay knows this is my personal hobby horse a lot of times, is the voice of unreason and you know, the kind of like disagreement with science and the disavowal and almost a deep cynicism for the things that come from science and that come from the engineering that we have, and it's disturbing to see. How can we kind of make sure that that's not impacting us?
Well, I think it's really stems from politics, and I think there's been an unfortunate alignment of certain science and technology issues with certain political points of view, and that turns people's logic off. On both sides.
Yeah.
And I think if we could elevate things that are in the realm of science and engineering back to that realm and not have them be somehow politicized, then I think we'd go a long way for that. But I don't know how you do that, because once it's happened, it's hard to change that meme, that association. And that's a challenge. But I think we need to do it. I think a lot of it can be done with dialogue and discussion. I think it's a matter of education and hearing what the concerns are. And there have been studies, I don't want to go too far into something like climate change, but there have been studies done that people who are skeptical of, quote, global warming, when they see packaging that talks about how something reduces carbon emissions and reduces the footprint, they will be more likely to buy that product than if that product says, hey, this will help stop global warming. Because for them, global warming equates with a political agenda.
Yeah.
But when they see the data of this is good for the planet, they all say, okay, of course. So it's a matter of how it's packaged and how it's presented and not politicized, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, and that's a discussion I've had with people, too, is that, well, whether you believe, you know, in the, you know, anthropogenic global warming or not, don't you still want to just do these things regardless?
And the answer is most people do.
Do, yes.
Most people do. It's a matter of how it's presented. And, and unfortunately, we're stuck in a world where people are still marketed and people know how to market things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes data can be dry. Right. Yeah. And so you've got to know how to package it so that people will understand it and take away the message and do it in such a way that you don't polarize them. That's my opinion.
Well, I want to thank you for your time, Dr. Yeah. Johnson. This has been a real privilege, and we're going to get you off of here and to your next panel to
All
keep
right.
spreading the gospel.
Well, I appreciate being on here. And if folks are interested, they can contact me at my website, www.lesjohnsonauthor.com. I'm also on Facebook at Les Johnson Author. And my email is les.mail@lesjohnsonauthor.com.
Very cool. Thank you so much
for
taking the
me.
Time. We
it's
really appreciate it. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that was Dr. Les Johnson. Awesome, awesome interview. Next, we're going to hear an interview with Ookla the Mock, but first, let's hear a little music from them. This is Mwahaha from their album Ookla the Mock versus Evil.
And let my evil laugh. I smoke my cat and then I steeple my hair. But my smoking bad as I reveal my plans. Now this lies still and now I try to decide what bad guy line applies in my diatribe. How about no Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Or maybe kneel before Zod or give yourself to the dark side.
From hell's heart, I stare at thee.
But wait until they get a load of me.
How about me?
Challenge the will of doom.
Yeah, I get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
Revenge is a dish best served cold.
I did it 20 minutes ago.
Take whatever booty you can find. But remember, the feast is mine.
I'm moving up to kidnapping, you should be more polite.
Yeah, but dance with the devil in the pale moonlight.
Just when I thought I was out there, pull me back in.
Curses foiled again.
Who fights and runs away? Lives to fight another day.
Feud, are you be assimilated?
Now while you hang there and consider your fate,
should I say release the hounds or just say exterminate?
I have something to say. It's better to burn out than to fade away.
Did I ever tell you how I got these scars?
I think the word you're looking for is ah.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Impressive, but you are not a Jedi yet.
It puts the lotion on his
WRLR, Round Lake Heights, Illinois, 98.3 FM.
So I'm sitting here on the conglomeration floor and podium with Ookla the Mock, which is made up of these two guys sitting here. I'm going to let you guys introduce yourselves, tell us a little bit about you. They are the musical guests of honor for the conglomeration convention. So, so we're very pleased to have you here, honored, and I'd love to hear a little more.
Certainly happy to be here. My name is Rand Bellavia. And next to me is...
Hi, I'm Adam, and we're moderately happy to be here.
that's about as much as we can hope for. Yeah. You know, if we get some moderate happiness...
moderate happiness is fine. You know, it's more than we can hope for.
It's certainly better than ennui, right?
Exactly. And we've got with us here too, of course, we've got Jay Garman sitting with us here on the stadium on the stage with us, and Dave Sparky Saganaki is piped in remotely. This time not from Canada.
Hi everybody.
There he is.
Hi Dave. Hey, you're supposed to join me.
Hello.
So we were just actually in starting up a conversation about how you guys kind of got your start. You know, an Ookla the Mock is not a easily recognizable name, perhaps, even...
I'll tell you, I wish we had that decision to make again.
we've been doing this for quite a while. We actually, Adam and I, we met in college, and we started writing songs together in the early 90s. And when we decided that what we had was, you know, something that could be real and that we could, you know, put together a band, we, of course... didn't want to perform as Rand and Adam or anything ridiculous like that. So
what we used to do is every time we were mostly playing open mics back then, and every time we played, we changed our name to something different, and we had just increasingly absurd names.
We were just trying to get the guy reading the the thing.
We were the Surfing Colonel from Apocalypse Now.
We were Bubastis, the genetically altered link.
Yeah, all fairly
wow. That's references. A Watchmen reference. Yeah, yeah, very sure nice.
Yeah. We had a million different names, and we were playing at bars, which I don't know if you know this, but most bars are not actually very appreciative of songs about Star Trek and superheroes.
Yeah, we found that out.
You're going to the wrong bars.
And we
found it out the hard way, but it was pretty easy to find that.
Yeah, it was exactly. I mean, people were throwing things at us. It was bad news. But
really?
A friend of ours had recommended that we try playing at Filk's, at Science Fiction Convention. For those of your listeners that don't know what Filk is, it's the music of science fiction fandom. And we didn't know that was a thing, but we played at a Filk, and the name that we had chosen when we played at a Filk was Ookla the Mock. And the next thing you know, Ookla the Mock was, and of course Ookla the Mock is a reference from the 1980 cartoon Thundar the Barbarian. And we thought no one would recognize the name, it was just we liked that it sounded funny. And the next thing you know, Ookla the Mock was receiving invitations to perform all over the country at science fiction conventions. So
I was saying before, it's frustrating because if we, you know, we made this decision before, the kind of the internet was really happening, and so we would have chosen a name that people could spell.
Yeah.
Because it's like all the time, you say, oh, we're Ookla the Mock, and even if people couldn't remember that, they go to type it in and.
Right.
The URL, and they don't,
There's no C in that anywhere.
Yeah, M-O-K.
And so that people are listening, it is spelled O-O-K-L-A, the Mock, M-O-K. And it refers, as you said, to Thunder. And that was the large cat-like.
Well, it was kind of like, if Chewbacca had evolved from raccoons. there you go. It's
well, and actually had more anger management issues.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and the other, we... always half-jokingly point out that our name is still a registered trademark for someone. And, one of these days somebody's going to say something to us about that. But so far, so good.
I think you've done more for Thundar Barbarian than the Thundar the Barbarian has ever done for you.
The truth is that the creator of Thundar the Barbarian,
Steve Gerber.
The late Steve Gerber, who also created Howard the Duck and many other fantastic comic books,
Hall of Fame
actually contacted us at some point in the late 90s to say, congratulations on outlasting the character you're named after. And, so again, he's not the copyright holder, but certainly the creator of the character gave us his blessing. So,
yeah.
Well, and even if that weren't true, I mean, any publicity is good publicity, anyway, right?
Yeah. Well, we'll see. That's what they say. You know, I don't know if getting sued by Ruby Spears or Hanna-Barbera would necessarily be, you know,
change
that much publicity.
That is the Streisand effect. I mean, that's what it's called.
If it does wind up being good publicity, though, we're changing our name to Mickey Mouse. Okay, so.
Excellent.
But yeah, we do, you know, nerdy music that's, you know, a lot of superhero stuff, a lot of Star Trek and Star Wars songs, but we try to keep it musically very, very accessible. We're pretty power poppy and. You know, try to make our music as accessible to the most people we can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, you guys are sort of you do this basically out of your garage. You're literally a garage band, I believe that has been said of you. So,
Well, these days we're more of a Macintosh band.
Yeah, I would say we've evolved into a garage band. I mean, when we first started out, we all of our albums were made in real studios. We hired real engineers and real producers, and we've made some by today's standards fairly big budget recording projects. But that's the thing about the digital revolution is these days. There's no, we make better records, we still do use recording studios, but most of our recording is done in my basement. Mm-hmm. And, these days you can make just amazing music. I would contend that the time we spent working with music industry professionals and, the engineers and producers that we've hired in the past, we wouldn't be able to do it the way we do it now if we didn't know what we were doing from having worked with people that, are better at it than we are.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Yeah, when you're, the quality of what you're doing at home may not match what you can do in a studio, but when you're at home, you can take your time. Or more importantly, it gives you the opportunity to do it, record the song, listen to it, realize, that's not the right arrangement. And redo it. Whereas if you paid all that money to be in a studio to record it and it's done and it functions, you have to decide, do we really want to spend all that money to re-record it? And so, when you're recording it at home, you really get it, you can really live with it and try different mixes, different tracks, different, arrangements.
Yeah.
It just makes it, it's a lot more in your control.
A lot of it is about that. It's, I think a lot about, we've talked quite a bit about, one of the technological advances in the last few years that everybody knows about is pitch correction with vocals and, not talking about auto-tune per se, where you do strange effects with you. I'm talking about just the fact that you can have your voice be totally in tune. And one of the things we love about that, we were very averse to the idea, as a lot of people were when it first came out, but what we discovered was that you get so much better tracks because it used to be that, if you did four takes of a particular line on a song, you have to use the one that's in tune. And now you use the best one and put it in tune. So when you're performing, particularly with vocals, you can get that, particular expression, that particular emotion that you're looking for in your performance, and then make it perfect. You don't have to take the one that's, this one really has that certain je ne sais quoi, but we can't use it because it's a little pitchy.
Yeah, and people that, poo-poo things like pitch correction, need to realize that before pitch correction, every vocal you heard was comped anyway. And what we mean by comped is that they would have the singer sing the song 10 or 15 times and then pay some engineer to go through and literally put it together. We're going to take, the bay of Baby from track 6 and then the B of Baby from track 15 and put them together so it's Baby. And to get, and it was Frankenstein together like that. That's the way they did vocals before pitch correction. And so now what you can do is you can, like Adam said, get the right emotional response, get the sublime take. Mm-hmm. And if it's, and that's the other thing is that if you listen to a Beatles album now, you'll notice, boy, Paul's a little out of pitch, because our ears are used to hearing things that are pitch corrected and the rhythms that are perfectly corrected, so that we're used to hearing things perfectly in rhythm, perfectly in pitch. And once your ear is used to that, it can't unhear it. And so, everything that's on the radio now,
yeah,
is adjusted rhythmically, and you know, and they adjust everything.
And I want to point out that, you know, Rand and I are both classically trained musicians. I mean, you know, we can sing. You know, it's not like we're pitchy when we sing, but the human voice is, you know, it's not an exact. It's not an exact instrument. It's not like a keyboard, an electronic keyboard, where you play a note and then that's the note you're going to get. That's not how the voice works.
Well, that's and something I was going to say too is that, you know, when you're doing, you know, things like pitch correction, you know, you really need to like the software that we use is a piece of British software called Melodyne, and when you use it, you can, you know, you load the song in and you push a button and it pitch corrects, but the last thing you want to do is go with that. Like, what we do is you've got to go through note by note. And sometimes you can look at it and, you know, the note that, you know, that you want to sing is an A, but it registers as an A flat. But when you move it up to an A, it doesn't sound right.
Hmm.
So sometimes you have to move it down to an A flat and adjust the timbre so that the pitch is a little lower, but maybe adjust the
timbre. There's an art to the technology of it.
You can't just look at the screen. You know, it's not just mathematical. You really... And, you know, and again, something like when we worked with producers in the past, one of the things we always said was that just because you can correct the note doesn't mean you should correct the note. Sometimes, like on the guitar, you know, just that little squeak or that little, you know what I mean, the little autotune squeal or something is cool. You know, it's not, you know, and this is rock and roll. We're not, you know, we're not an orchestra. So, you know, sometimes, you know, there's an advantage to it being less than perfect. But, you know, but like I said, I think the big problem is that our ears have become so used to hearing perfection, and the trick is to make it, you know, correct and right without sounding antiseptic.
Well,
sounding...
yeah, and I was going to ask about that. So, I mean, one of the things that you notice with the really overcorrected, pitch-corrected stuff is the attack on the notes is very noticeable. The decays out of them are very noticeable. Yeah. Does the software manage that, or is that...
Melodyne does if you know how to use it. Like I said, you can adjust every parameter, and to be honest, a lot of what we've done with what we'll do is we'll take the time to melodyne each song to our satisfaction, you know, and you're looking at just the vocal track, and then we lay it back in the song, and sometimes we always keep the original track, and a lot of times we'll melodyne it, we'll lay it back in, and we'll listen, and we'll say, you know what, that, and we'll have to go back in either part of the song or maybe the whole song, we'll say, we're going to use the original vocal track.
Yeah, oftentimes it's like, you know, you'll get that one section where you're like, you know, it just sounds too antiseptic. Even after we've finessed it on Melodyne, I like the original better, and it's, you know, the fact is it's usually not that out of pitch. It's, you know, the human ear does a lot of that pitch correction for you when you listen to music.
And especially, like, on the heavier, like, the more kind of hard rock, metal-y songs where you get that growl in your voice, well, obviously the software, because it's growly, it doesn't understand what... Sometimes, you know, you're not really singing a note. You're just singing something, you know. And that's when the pitch correction, you can't use it. Because, you know, if you want to
I'm sure if we were to buy the current edition of Melodyne, I bet they fix that problem. You know,
growl feature.
Yeah, you know. That's the thing, is that this technology evolves so quickly. Another thing that we've and again, this was something that we railed against for years, because Rand and I, you know, it's we still play real instruments, and recently we were playing with some friends of ours from out the Chicagoland area, and we got on stage and we're loading up our guitars and so forth, and they said, "Oh, real instruments? How 20th century?" And I was just like, oh, really? Are we up to that now? But something else that we have railed against for forever, but I have now really embraced, is all the drums on this on our newest album, on Uko the Mach versus Evil, are synthetic. There we use a piece of software called Easy Drummer, and it is wonderful. I think I believe it's $99 for that software. And
$99, you can replace Ringo Starr.
I mean, you know, Ringo can't play like Easy Drummer can.
I know, you can have Ringo Starr. What it is, is all the sounds are samples of live drum sounds. And if you know, like, for a little more money, you could say, give me John Bonham's, you know, kick drum. You know
what I
mean? And you can, so, but then you can manipulate. You create the beat you want.
Yeah.
You can manipulate it any way you want. But the actual cymbal hit is a recording of a cymbal hit. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's not created by a computer, you know?
Yeah. So, and it's like Rand says, is that, you know, if you like a particular, if you want to, you know, your drummer to sound like John Bonham, there's, like, you know, a $70 plug-in for it where you can have his actual drum set. actually recorded, and you can adjust every parameter. You write the beats yourself. I mean, they have standard beats that you start with, but then you adjust them to, if you want it a little swung, and it's very human sounding. It's the producer that we had done a big budget album a few years ago, and we had hired a name producer to produce it. And when we showed him this new album, he said, "Well, are those all synthetic drums, really?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, who programmed them?" And I said, "I did." And he's like, "Well, he's like, I can tell there's certain moments in the album that I can tell." And this is a veteran record producer. So there's moments that I can tell that they're not real drums, but no consumer level person is going to be able to tell that. And it really is a matter of, you don't just slap in a beat and let it play through the song. You have to really, we wouldn't be able to do that if we hadn't worked with a bunch of different drummers and had a feel for how a drummer plays. You know, you almost have to be able to play the drums in order to, in order to use the software to its potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think that there is, if not an easily defined line, a line there where you can say this is the creative part of this instrument's effort, and this is the, I just have to do the exact same thing 30 times in a row exactly right?
Well, it's
part.
Funny you say that, because one of the things that also has, that we resisted for a while is the idea that if you are doing the exact same thing 30 times, do it twice and copy and paste it. I mean, and that's something that, 10 years ago, I would have been like, man, that's not right. But the fact is that if you see us live, we will prove to you that we can play that for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I can sing the song and stay in pitch. It's about, what really kind of got it in my head is the fact that, particularly with vocals, we really resisted a lot of effects and a lot of, tricks. But I realize it's like I play the electric guitar and, I'm perfectly okay with using all sorts of effects and pedals and things that allow my guitar to sustain longer than I can get it to sustain and to distort more than I can distort it. So why resist doing that with my voice? I still ultimately have to play the guitar. I still ultimately have to sing the part. Mm-hmm. And like I said, where the rubber hits the road is, can you reproduce it live? Mm-hmm. The people that are using these tools to, in other words, we never use pitch correction to hit a note that we can't hit, or to sustain a note that we couldn't sustain.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You got to, because at some point you got to take pride in the fact that why'd we learn how to sing and play guitar if we're just going to, have the machines do it for us?
Yeah.
But at the same time, sometimes, if the goal is to get that guitar, if it's a kind of a rhythm guitar figure and the goal is to have it play the same through the whole song, and not draw attention to itself, then, it's just as much effort to play it through as it is for me to play for 3 seconds and just copy and paste it. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny how I was just thinking how technology, it definitely, every step of it gets resisted, everybody thoughts, do you remember the first time you saw someone talking on a cell phone, what your reaction was? You're like, who do they think they are? what do you need that for? It's ridiculous. And then once you have a cell phone in your pocket, you instantly can't live without it. But then when texting came out, we all did the exact same thing. You see people texting, like, that's ridiculous. Why wouldn't you just call the person and say, but now that you text, you realize how much better it is. And it's like that with, I'm sure, I'm sure that when the electric guitar happened, people were like, well, that's not really playing guitar, A guitar isn't really that loud, and, there's all these technological things that you do, and, I don't know, you do have to find, there's a needle to thread, you have to find a fine line.
Because, yeah. The fact that you're recording it, obviously music is designed to be heard acoustically, meaning it's designed to be heard by a person producing music in a room with someone whose ears are hearing it. But, by the time you're recording it, you're like 8 levels removed from the pure experience. Because even a live performance, there's microphones and amps, which, takes you away from that kind of primal experience of hearing it. And you add the recording level and it's even, you've had the experience of seeing a concert and then hearing a recording of that concert later, and you realize, wow, that doesn't sound as good as,
totally
as I did. because when you're alive, you're more, your ear is more forgiving.
Yeah.
You know, part of it is because you're designed to hear it live and raw while it's happening, but also mm-hmm. your other senses are engaged. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You're seeing it, you're feeling the bass, and you're, you know, and when you hear a recording, you know, you're much less forgiving, which is why, you know, we started to use these tricks to kind of, you know, cover up the reality.
Well, and our standards are higher. I was thinking, though, you know, you're talking about like the electric guitars and the influence of technology in music, but in a sense, I think you could almost make the argument that technology has always been a part of music. I mean, you go back to electric guitars like Mickey Baker making his own guitars, you know, to do what he wanted to do. Prior to that, you go all the way back to the original wind instruments and just trying to make stuff right so that it would sound consistent.
Well, I mean, for instance,
and it's what we're doing now, but electronics.
You go to the early 20th century, pre-microphone, you know, all popular singing was done by sopranos and tenors. Okay.
Because they could project.
Because there is no Frank Sinatra without a microphone.
Mm.
There's no Elvis Presley without a microphone.
You know, the microphone allows Frank Sinatra to sing with an orchestra and be heard. You know, but that, you know, where he's just so in the mid-range, you know, if he was born 20 years earlier, we'd never have heard of him.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny how that becomes a, like, you know, I remember somebody pointing out to me once that Elvis Presley was somebody who, you know, one of the main things he did well was he knew how to sing into a microphone. There's an art to using the technology. And that's that for sure. We find that that's true. You know, it's anybody that's ever been in a rock band knows that you can sit in your living room and practice the song by yourself, and you can even plug in and play it electrically and so forth. But standing in front of the microphone and playing it while singing into the microphone, that's its own deal, and that'll trip you up if you don't practice that particular set of skills. You know?
And in particular, with you know a band like Ookla, where you know Adam and I both sing lead vocals pretty
in
much
every
on every
song.
You know, like we're either training up vocals or we're singing in tight harmony, or you know, or we're doing counterpoint, and to the point where, and often like there's songs where like literally it'll be like a one bar line and I'll start singing the melody and end singing the harmony.
Yeah.
So you have to work the microphone. You have to, you know, like, you have to, if you
get on it, get off
five,
it.
You'll notice that, you know, our heads bob like chickens the whole time, because like when we're on the melody, we got to be right up on the mic, and then you got to back away because you can't expect someone to mix you like that.
I can think of several examples in our song where in the same line, I sing melody, harmony to you, and counterpoint to you.
Like our arrangements are a little absurd. And but, you know, and that's one of the things that, you know, we've given up on the idea of having someone that could mix us and figure that out. And it's, again, with as far as recording technology, one of the things that's, we used to have to, you know, our first, you know, three or four records, you know, we did a live mix, so analog mix. And usually when we mixed, I was kind of the one that was, you know, I've got a fairly prodigious memory. So I was the one who was on the board making sure that, okay, we need the hi-hat louder for, you know, that section there. And we need, you know, trying to ride the vocals because of, you know, as we're switching off. And when you're mixing live, there's an art to that, because if it's a 4-minute song and you're 3 minutes and 15 seconds into it and you forget to do, you have to redo the whole thing. And now with digital mixing, you can just sit there and say, okay, you can automate the track and you can say, okay, this vocal track, you know, bars 17 to 25, we're going to take that down 10 dBs. You know what I mean? So that you don't have to ride it at all. You can adjust it, and you can mix it and save it.
Yeah, automated
mixing. And if you decide you don't like it, you can pull back and the mix you did is there.
Yeah, you can tweak an existing mix.
You don't have to remix it. And so the digital mixing has really made our life so much easier.
I really enjoyed how you described yourself as having a prodigious memory, which is, I usually just call him a freak. that's one of the things about our songwriting is that Rand's got a, you know, he before there was an internet, you just used Rand. You know, I mean,
I knew we could relate somehow.
Yeah. Well, it does bother me that people assume that I'm looking stuff up. You know, they're like, oh, you just Google that. I'm like,
I know everything.
That. Doesn't it feel like you wasted your life, though? You know, because
no, it bothers me. My wife calls me at work because she won't go IMDb something, and she thinks it's easier to call me. Who was that one guy? Jeff Bridges.
Oh, right. He played Boz on Riptide. Yeah, it's I've always said about Rand. We had a piece of good luck a number of years ago. We sold a song to Disney, and it became the theme song for a Saturday morning cartoon called Fillmore that was really cool. And when we went out to Hollywood to do the deal, as they say, we were in the recording studio, and one of the producers from Disney took us over to the recording studio. And Rand says to the engineer, "Oh, I can see by your Rickenbacker bass and your, you know, something Hoffer, else,
actually.
Yeah, whatever it was, that you're a Paul McCartney fan." He's like, "Did you just read the new book on Paul McCartney?" And the guy's like, "Oh my God, I'm reading that right now." And so then Rand says, "Blah blah blah blah." So I turned to the producer that's from Disney that had brought us over there, and I say to him, "The great thing about being friends with Rand is he knows everything." I said, "Whatever the thing is that you know the most about, like your thing, he knows more about that than you do." And then as soon as I had finished saying that, Rand turns to Rand starts talking to the producer, and the producer said something, and Rand's like, "Oh, you just quoted something from the, you know, Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. You must be reading 10 poems to change your life." And I know it wasn't really the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, but and he's like, "Oh my God, I'm reading that right now." And so I turn to the recording guy, and I say, "The great thing about being friends with Rand is he knows everything." I just like said the exact same thing I memorized to say in those circumstances.
All right, well, we're up on time here, fellas, and this has been great. And I must say, if you want to market the band, these conversations would be great. Like, if you wrote a blog on how to engineer your own music, I would read it.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
That sounds like work.
Yeah, you're musicians.
Let's just do a podcast.
It may there be. You go.
I know. Absolutely. Right, that's a great idea. In fact, you guys can go. We'll just take over from
all
here.
Right.
It would
is Rand and Adam with the
guys, really.
With the Mock Podcast.
It would fall into the growing list of podcasts better than the one that I do. So that would not be a problem. So to close out, though, when people are looking now to get access to your music, to find out more about the things that you've got queued up, to your tour schedules and so on.
Yeah,
do we go?
Certainly, I mean, you know, the best place to go would just be our website, which is ukulelemock.com. We also have a Facebook page that I keep updated pretty regularly. But if you're looking for our music, you really can find it anywhere. You can find music online at the word iTunes, at Amazon, at
We CD like you to Baby. Use CD Baby.
And plus, they're just if you don't know about CD Baby, go to cdbaby.com, and they're a fantastic organization for musicians.
And we are Ukla the Mock, OOKLA, the MOK.
Our new album is called Ukla the Mock Versus Evil.
It's really good. It's about supervillains of all stripes.
And for those of you who have never heard Ukla the Mock's music, they have successfully name dropped Grant Morrison's The Invisible in a song. That is a feat by itself.
A couple of them, if I'm not mistaken.
Excellent. And I will be playing some of this music for people that are listening to this interview for us. If I was going to choose one song out of here that you'd say, this is the song people need to hear off of Ukla the Mock Versus Evil?
What's your lead single?
Oh, boy. Well, I think that the one that they would most enjoy might be Dr. Octopus.
All right.
It's a little hip-hoppy. It's a little rap. It's pretty accessible, and it's funny. And it's about Dr. Octopus. Where can you go wrong?
Check out my limbs, is eight. I'm Dr. Octopus. That's right, I'm him, I'm great. I'm Dr. Octopus. Rocktopus, Doctopus. Watch the groupies, Flactopus. When I'm busting rhymes like your hand, Sebastian Octopus. I'm Dr. Octopus. Octopus. I was a weak geek before I was Dr. Octopus. Sitting watching Star Trek 3, The Search for Spocktopus. Moctopus by Doctopus. My face was acne poctopus. My buddy was always waiting at home. I'd have to walktopus. Every single day after school at 3 o'clocktopus. My walktopus been jamming to New Kids on the Blocktopus. He scoffed at my nose, a socktopus. I coughed himself, he knocked my blocktopus. I'm gonna get a friend and I'm gonna get revenge. I shot the jerk off Joctopus. I'm Dr. Octopus. Octopus, There's really only one who could hang with Dr. Octopus. Last night at karaoke, we sang one night at Bank Octopus. He served the one eye octopus, disturbed by the gore shell octopus. Permit me to introduce you to my good friend, Eddie Brock.
Yo, what up? I'm the one they call Venom. I'm gonna track Spider-Man down Venom. I'm gonna thank him kindly for the use of his secondhand clothes. Hand-me-downs that he found lying around the battle world. That's where half of me originated. The half of me that you see, the rest is sublimated. That's my sentiment, but then again, I represent sentient alien symbiosis. That means my super suit is smarter than my foes is. Half jealous journalist and half E.T. I blend them when I can, I get them Venom, that's me.
Check out my versatile white lab octopus. When I'm finger painting, it's my style and art's octopus. Fenced octopus by Choctopus. Down my door, an octopus. My style is able manic like Blake or Della Quacopus.
Your suit's fine, but check out mine. My suit's a kind of sentient alien slime. I'm dressed to the nines, refined and pleased to meet you. Now give my shoes a shine or I'll tell my suit to eat you.
Venom's veins are filled with ice water. Tip top of the police blood. To bear witness to my slaughter when I spy Spider-Man with a fly swatter.
Oh, Doc Ox, the cock of the walk. He's gonna mock death lock like a jock rock shock jock. Doc Ox, crazy like a rabid fox. Like he smokes mad rock or a tainted guac. Don't be shocked if he empties his Glock on the old folks' home or the flock at Woodstock. He wears socks underneath his Crocs and he likes to rock to Ookla the Mock. Oh, Doc, he's got so many limbs, nobody can count all the limbs on him. There's a lot.
Eight.
Yeah, like approximately eight.
No, there's eight. Exactly eight.
That's what I'm saying.
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
Venom, we're saying two different things.
At least two.
I will crush your bones.
Yeah, you will.
Stop agreeing with me.
I will. Stop. I will stop agreeing with you. Right up your